Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. People in the coal fields are worried. Jobs are disappearing, and there isn't a lot of hope right now.
It's gotten about as bad, the economy has, about as bad as it's been since the 80s.
Some politicians think that fighting the Obama administration's policies in court will help the economy.
Clearly, the regulatory environment has been very difficult for West Virginia coal miners and their families.
While other groups are creating jobs with federal grant money.
You know, when I first came up with the idea, I was pitching my business plan, and this guy literally laughed in my face. And he said, "You're never going to find anybody that wants to work in southern West Virginia. But if you get below the surface, you'll find some very resilient, very resourceful people that are finding a new way forward."
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia.
I'm gonna live forever. I'm gonna cross that river. I'm gonna catch tomorrow now.
Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're talking about coal communities. We're going to take a closer look at some of the politics surrounding coal's decline. What are folks doing to try to help people living in coalfield communities? And what are elected officials doing? And of course, what do you think?
Don't let the darkness take them. Don't make them feel forsaken. Just lead them safely to the light. When this old world is blown asunder and all the stars fall from the sky, remember someone really loves you. We'll live forever, you and I.
We'll start by traveling to a small coal community in Mingo County, West Virginia. Many people in the coal fields throughout Appalachia have to travel hours to see medical specialists that treat the chronic health issues prevalent in the region. According to the West Virginia Rural Health Association, the state lacks a variety of specialists, including cardiologists, surgeons, and oncologists. Lack of access to good health care is one of many disadvantages people in coal communities struggle to overcome. This isn't a new problem, but it's a problem that could grow as Appalachia's population ages and as rural areas become even more sparsely populated. While some folks have to travel hours to find these specialists, a group of doctors from WVU have found a way to meet the need where it is. Glynis Board takes us to Gilbert.
A man living in Fairfax County, Virginia, will likely live 15 years longer than one 300 miles away in southern West Virginia, in a town like Gilbert, in Mingo County. Of course, it's easy to forget about Mingo County. You don't visit towns there like Gilbert accidentally. It takes a concerted effort. It's a world where coal is still the dominant industry, but the population is aging. And according to data from the U.S. Census and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the region is home to some of the poorest and least healthy communities in the country. So once a month, for the past decade, the brothers Brick, Dr. James Brick, a rheumatologist, and Dr. John Brick, a neurologist, well, they make that trip. They used to wake up at 3 a.m. and drive 4 or 5 hours from Morgantown, but today they can usually cut the first leg of the trip substantially.
We're on the West Virginia University Foundation plane. We just left Morgantown and we're going to Charleston.
When was the first time you went down? Do you remember?
Yes, I'll never forget that. That was a wonderful trip. The clinic was full. And almost all the patients dressed in gold and blue. So we had...
That's Dr. John. And before him, Dr. James. They are identical twins from Dunbar. They both smile, remembering how everyone in the clinic showed up wearing WVU's gold and blue colors that first trip to Gilbert over a decade ago. Dr. James Brick is a professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at WVU, and Dr. John Brick is a professor and the chair of the Neurology Department at WVU. In the hour and a half winding and scenic van ride from Charleston to Gilbert, the brother doctors told attending med students stories about the community. Dr. John Brick told them a little bit about the economy.
Well, it's a small town. It's maybe 200 or 300 people. The major source of jobs there was the mining business, and Mr. Harless had a very large sawmill operation there. Now the sawmills have closed, but there are still mines in the area.
The brothers Brick love to reminisce about their old friend and former patient who was instrumental in bringing them to southern West Virginia to begin with, the late Buck Harless. Mr. Harless, they say, had an epic life. He started in the world orphaned and died a legend, with timber and sawmill interests in 5 states, manufacturing operations in 4 states, and also holdings in real estate and coal. But Gilbert, they say, was always Buck Harless's home, and he invested in it. Harless built this huge facility, 55,000 square feet, that kind of looks a little out of place in this tiny town. He built it for his community, and he named it after his deceased son. It houses a track, a pool, a cinema, basketball courts, and the health clinic. So about 3 hours and 200 miles later, the doctors and the med students arrive at the Larry Joe Harless Community Center.
I've been coming to see the rheumatologist here ever since this clinic started because I live just up the street, so it's very easy to come.
Marisha White is visiting the clinic today to see rheumatologist Dr. James Brick.
I'll see you.
Okay. All right.
Behave yourself.
I'll try. Okay. I'll try.
Bye-bye.
Marisha says Dr. Brick saves her from having to make the 2-hour trip to Huntington, where her regular rheumatologist is.
It's very important because people are able to see specialists while I can drive if I feel like it or have family that will take me. A lot of local people have trouble with transportation and even getting to Logan or Williamson, which would be the closest place for they can see a specialist. So it's very important to have a neurologist and a rheumatologist and a cardiologist that these people can see.
Dr. James Brick explains how it can be difficult for a specialty doctor to sustain a practice in a sparsely populated rural region. But he says there is a need because the aging population has a lot of chronic illness.
This was a town that has a lot of retired folks living in it, retired miners, people retired from working in the sawmills and in the timber business. See lots of osteoarthritis. That's the most common form of arthritis. See good number of people with rheumatoid arthritis, gout, some people with fibromyalgia. I'd say those are the most common diagnoses that we see, but that's also the most common diagnoses we see in Morgantown.
But Mingo County is a little different. It's in an area that has one of the worst life expectancy rates in the nation. In fact, according to mortality data from the National Center for Health Statistics, while life expectancy has slowly been increasing throughout the nation, it's actually been dropping in regions of southern West Virginia.
MCP is the other one. Okay, there we go.
Today, Dr. James Brick is also teaching medical student Audrey Jajoski about managing patient care.
It's since age 38, but more recently.
No. How long is she stiff in the morning?
Oh, didn't ask that.
Yeah, you got that. If you see somebody with rheumatoid arthritis, that's probably the most important thing you can ask them.
The doctors Brick see some patients fairly regularly, and it's clear that both he and his brother have an affinity for the town and the region. They sponsor local basketball teams, fire off trivia with visiting med students about the area, and they were recently honored by leaders in the community for dedicating time in their practice every month for over a decade. Dr. John, the neurologist, also observes that medically, the patients he sees are not different from those he treats in the rest of the state.
They have the same problems as virtually every other population in West Virginia. But I do think the people are unique. They're wonderful people. They're very appreciative. They're fun to interact with. You get a lot of satisfaction from taking care of them. This is my job. I'm paid to do this, but I'd probably do this if I had a way to do this after I retired. It is so much fun to come down here and see these patients and share my knowledge with them. And they share a little bit of their life with me. And that's what makes it worth it.
Interim president of Marshall University, Gary White, says the clinic in Gilbert is a successful example of the power of collaboration because all three of the main medical schools in the state, WVU, Marshall, and the West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine, work together to provide equipment and services.
Here in this little town of Gilbert, we can provide the services that folks desperately need and fulfill the vision that Mr. Harless had. I think this is a model that can be replicated time and time again. It can be replicated all across the state. And frankly, in the new healthcare model that the United States is creating, this is the model.
A native of neighboring Logan County, White says towns like Gilbert will languish and die without creative and motivated community members. White says the area faces stark challenges today, especially economically, as the coal industry the community relies on has been declining. But he has hope for the future. He believes his community will adjust. And he believes that the generation that came before has paved the way, literally, for them to do so. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Gilbert.
The clinic in Gilbert is one of 35 WVU medical clinics across West Virginia. So, how are some people in Appalachia working to help the economy? We'll take a closer look after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Our roots with coal run deep here in Central Appalachia, but the future for the people here in the Appalachian coalfields is unclear. Although coal will likely still continue to be mined, it doesn't seem like jobs in the industry will ever come back, not like they once were.
I don't know if it would ever get any better. What they need to concentrate on is, you know, if they want to do away with the coal, just bring some other industry in here for us to do. I mean, I'll be 45. And if they had a Toyota plant close by or something, I mean, I don't expect to make miners' wages.
That's William Lusk, an underground coal miner with about 24 years' experience working in southern West Virginia. We first heard from William on this show in September of last year. The comment inspired one of our listeners to write us this letter. Carly Marinick of Monroe County, West Virginia writes, "As a consistent listener to your program, I wish to thank you for the invitation to share thoughts on the future of West Virginia in response to a recent program on the loss of coal jobs. One of the young men interviewed commented that he didn't care what the job was, he just wanted to work. My suggestion is that West Virginia turns over a new leaf, away from extractive industries and become a leader in the manufacture of solar panels. This could solve multiple problems simultaneously by radically increasing employment opportunities while providing clean energy for West Virginia and cost savings for heating both residential and commercial buildings. Thank you for your letter, Carly. This discussion is critical for our region now. In the last 4 years, more than 13,300 coal miners have lost their jobs in West Virginia alone. While some of the data for the latest quarter is incomplete, Workforce West Virginia was able to track about 7,800 or 58% of those coal miners. The agency told me in an email that of those they've tracked so far, most were able to find work in state. It's not clear what kind of work they found or if they had to move in the state to find it, but the number one private employer in the state is Walmart. and in early February, the Walmart in McDowell County, West Virginia, closed. Without good-paying jobs, several feeder industries will suffer. In Mercer County, several restaurants have closed in the last few months. There's a lot at stake for Appalachians, so the future of coal is a political issue here, and one you likely have strong feelings about either way. And there's plenty of blame, too. Blame for the EPA, for the natural gas industry, for the way coal company executives are running coal companies. Many people blame the Obama administration's environmental policies for the sharp decline in the coal industry. A 2014 Gallup poll shows that two states where the president had some of the worst approval ratings in the country were, Kentucky and West Virginia. In an interview last December, NPR's Steve Inskeep asked President Obama about his approval ratings.
If you're living in a town that historically has relied on coal and you see coal jobs diminishing, you're probably going to be more susceptible to the argument that I've been wiping out the economy in your area. And you know, it doesn't matter if I tell them actually it's probably because natural gas is a lot cheaper now. And so it doesn't play to build coal plants. Somebody tells you that this is because of Obama's war on coal, well, you know, that's an argument that you may be sympathetic to. And that's perfectly legitimate.
That was President Obama on NPR's Morning Edition on December 21st last year. Folks are reacting in different ways to one of Obama's policies, the Clean Power Plan. Elected officials in 29 states have joined forces to challenge the Clean Power Plan. It's a case that was headed to the Supreme Court, but a recent decision sends it to the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court stunned the Environmental Protection Agency recently by freezing its signature plan to reduce carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. The decision, a 5-4 vote, granted the coal industry, 29 states and state agencies, a stay on complying with the plan while it undergoes judicial review. Our friends over at the Allegheny Front have been covering this story closely. Following the Supreme Court's announcement, the show's host, Kara Holsapple, talked with the Allegheny Front's science reporter, Reed Frazier, about what this historic decision could mean for environmentalists and for the coal industry.
I'll just back up and explain what the Clean Power Plan is really quickly. It's kind of the heart of the Obama administration's plan to do something about climate change. Coal-fired power plants are the biggest source of carbon dioxide in the United States, and this plan was aimed at limiting the emissions of carbon from that sector. So a bunch of energy states and energy companies asked the Supreme Court to basically just put a hold on the plan while the plan works its way through the courts and eventually the Supreme Court. The courts never granted this kind of stay, and this time, to many people's surprise, it did.
How has this decision been received?
Well, it's basically been a shock to almost everyone who has been following this case. Environmentalists and the industry were both kind of taken by surprise by the ruling, and that's because Supreme Court's been around a long time, and it's never done this. It's never just said, hey, you got to stop. We're going to wait and see if this rule is legal before you are allowed to go ahead and do it. It's always let the agencies proceed. And I spoke to Scott Osteich. He's an attorney for Murray Energy, one of the plaintiffs on the case. And this is what he said about his reaction to the decision. Scale of 1 to 10, how shocked were you?
9, because the horse handicappers had said that the Supreme Court has never done this before. That's a pretty good indication that the Supreme Court won't do this. So they've opened up a completely new role for the court that has heretofore never once been invoked.
Why is this decision important in coal-producing states like West Virginia?
Well, what it does immediately for them is it allows them to basically ignore the rule for the next 18 months to 2 years while it works its way through the courts. And essentially, they don't have to make any plans to cut carbon, and they can kind of proceed in a business-as-usual manner the way they are now. In fact, Kentucky, which was in the middle of making a plan to comply with the Clean Power Plan, just announced that they aren't going to do it. They're not going to make a plan, and they're going to wait it out and see what the Supreme Court says.
What about Pennsylvania?
Well, Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf is a Democrat. He supports the Clean Power Plan, and Pennsylvania is going to go ahead and keep writing a plan. But eventually, they're probably going to have to hit pause on their plan because, you know, the Supreme Court won't decide this for a while.
So does this decision mean that the Supreme Court is willing to overturn the Clean Power Plan?
That's a really important and central question that has come up. And basically the answer is yeah. The Supreme Court, one of the hurdles they have to meet in issuing a stay on a rule like this is they have to decide, does it look likely that this rule will be deemed illegal? Does it look likely that the appellants, in this case, states like West Virginia and energy companies, have a good case? And the five justices who sided with those states and those companies are basically saying, yeah, they have a pretty good case here. So it's a bad omen, no matter how you slice it, for the EPA. Now, the Obama administration has said, well, this is a bump in the road. We're pretty confident that we'll win on the merits of the case. But anybody who's looking at this has to look at this as bad news for the rule in the long run.
What about the commitments that President Obama made to cutting carbon emissions at the UN climate talks in Paris? How does this decision affect those commitments?
It could affect it an awful lot. It's the Clean Power Plan is the main mechanism that the U.S. was going to use to achieve its climate goals that it set for itself in Paris. I spoke with Ann Carlson. She is a law professor at the UCLA School of Law who's been following the case. And she says this definitely has implications beyond the U.S.
Basically, what the court just did is took out the heart of the United States plan that is, again, part of this global agreement. And it sends a signal to the rest of the world that the United States cannot live up to its commitment if this rule is going to be struck down.
Carlson said there's a pretty good chance that this case goes against the EPA. And if it does, then the next administration, be they Republican or Democrat, if they choose to address climate change, they're probably going to have to reassess what role the EPA can play in making that happen.
When will the Supreme Court rule on this? What are the next steps?
Well, the case is kind of getting fast-tracked through the appellate court. So their D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to hear the case this summer. And the fastest that the Supreme Court could hear an argument would be next fall. That would be the fall of 2017. So we're talking a good 18 months before a decision, maybe 2 years, something like that. So it's going to be a while.
Well, thanks very much, Reed.
Thank you.
That was the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier speaking with Kara Hulsoppel. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. West Virginia has taken the lead role in the case meant to fight the Clean Power Plan in court. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey is the lead litigator. He says the plan was an overreach by the Obama administration. Just days after the announcement by the Supreme Court, Morrissey discussed the issue with Ashton Mara on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's program, The Legislature Today.
So let's start with an explanation.
Sure.
I think some people don't really understand what a stay actually means.
No, it's a great question. And this decision this week really was monumental for the Mountain State and really for the entire country, because by obtaining a stay at the U.S. Supreme Court, we've basically frozen this regulation, the president's Clean Power Plan. The reason why that's so important is because we're probably not going to have a decision on the merits of this regulation until next spring at the U.S. Supreme Court. By having a regulation in place, even though we think that it ultimately won't be upheld in court, that puts real pressure on the states and a lot of the utilities to spend a significant amount of money trying to come into compliance. What this says is, let's put a halt on it. Let's put our pens down and let's let the legal process play its way out. And therefore, we won't be putting at risk potentially spending hundreds of millions or billions of dollars for a regulation that's probably not going to get upheld in the courts.
So what comes next in the lawsuit process?
Sure.
Where does this go for West Virginia and for your office particularly?
Well, our office is leading this 27-state litigation, and right now we're in the process of submitting the legal briefs before the D.C. Circuit. There will be oral argument June 2nd in Washington, D.C. The judges will probably make a decision on the merits in D.C. sometime late in the summer or into the fall, and then my guess is whoever loses this case at the D.C. Circuit will appeal before the U.S. Supreme Court. Then they're going to take in briefs, and there'll be oral arguments next spring. So the value of the stay is it really shifts some of this decision to the next president.
Okay. So do you believe that this honestly will make a difference for the industry? We hear lawmakers say every day that the global markets are the reason that both the coal and the natural gas industries are struggling in West Virginia right now. So does this really impact what's happening in West Virginia?
I think it will, but I think people have to understand what the expectation should be. There has been a tremendous amount of carnage, at least in part due to some of the regulations that have come out of Washington. And of course, there are a lot of different factors impacting coal and the layoffs. But clearly, the regulatory environment has been very difficult for West Virginia coal miners and their families. What I'm hoping this big win does is it actually stops some of the blood loss, and that we can actually say, okay, there's now hope on the horizon, and we can begin to fix this, because this administration has been pushing this illegal regulation, and now we have a chance to say, wait a minute, this is actually not going to see the light of day. We're eventually going to prevail. And what that means is maybe there'll be an opportunity for capital to flow back into the state. And then maybe if people are thinking of laying folks off because of the terrible regulatory environment or there's too much coal on the ground, people say, well, you know what? Now there's a big victory that we have. Let's hold on a little bit because brighter days are in front of us.
Again, that was Patrick Morrissey speaking with Ashton Mara on the legislature today. Again, the stay was granted in a case filed with the U.S. Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia Circuit Court. But like West Virginia's Attorney General Patrick Morrissey just said, it's likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court regardless of the ruling. And right now, that court has a vacant seat. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia passed away just days after the stay was ordered. Justice Scalia was considered a loyal conservative. Supreme Court justices are nominated by the president but still need approval by the U.S. Senate. So we reached back out to Morrissey to get his take on how or if the vacancy will influence the case. Here's part of what Morrissey's press secretary, Curtis Johnson, sent back to us. Justice Scalia's death unquestionably leaves a large void, but it's difficult to predict the impact his absence will have on any specific issue, including our challenge of the EPA's power plan. Still, others say Scalia's absence will change the outcome of this case. John Upton, a senior science writer at Climate Central, wrote, "In dying, Scalia may have done more to support global climate action than most people will do in their lifetimes." According to Climate Central's website, the organization's mission is to communicate the science and effects of climate change to the public and decision makers. But we don't know how this will all turn out just yet. And while politicians continue to try and stop the EPA's Clean Power Plan, President Obama has pledged to help struggling coal-dependent communities. One way is through the Appalachian Regional Commission. The ARC's mission is to innovate, partner, and invest to build community capacity and strengthen economic growth in Appalachia. The president's budget for 2017 requested $120 million for the ARC, and according to a release, the budget request is the largest for the agency in more than three decades. The funds include $50 million for an initiative meant to help communities suffering from the decline in coal jobs. You might have heard of it. It's because some projects are already underway. It's called the POWER Initiative, which stands for Partnerships for Opportunity in Workforce and Economic Revitalization. The multi-agency effort includes the ARC, the Department of Labor, and the Environmental Protection Agency. The POWER Initiative targets federal resources to help communities and regions affected by job losses in the coal industry. I spoke with the federal co-chair of the Appalachian Regional Commission, Earl Gohl, shortly after the president proposed his 2017 budget. In this area, there's not only layoffs in the industry, but people are losing their jobs in other businesses as well. Restaurants, stores, the Walmart comes to mind in McDowell County leaves a big hole in that area for people to even get fresh, healthy food. The same county just announced eliminating jobs in the school system, and others are also considering layoffs within the school system. Is Central Appalachia in a crisis, you think? How important do you think are these funds to this area?
I think that these funds are very important to Appalachian communities that are impacted by the reduction in coal. That throughout Appalachia, there are an incredible group of activists and individuals who were very focused on building and making their communities better places to live. And we're looking forward to partnering with many of those organizations to provide for a federal investment that helps leverage the next opportunity. From my point of view, I see Appalachia as the next great investment opportunity in America. And it's important that we use these funds and we leverage these funds in a way that helps us achieve and to reach out and achieve the potential that the region has.
When we spoke about a year ago, you said that the ARC had many success stories and regions in Appalachia that are thriving. It seems to be the common denominator for those success story, or at least one, was that they diversified their economies, and regions that have not diversified are struggling. We have deep roots with the coal industry here, and as we know, it's not going away immediately. But how important is it to diversify these communities?
Well, the coal industry is always going to be important in West Virginia. It's part of the culture. Folks have supported their families and have worked their entire lives underground or in other parts of the industry. It's an important part, and it's going to stay an important part of the West Virginia economy. But it's also important to look at other opportunities and to make sure that we reach out and we look beyond just extraction economies, but that we look at other opportunities and we take advantage of them. And these funds are an approach and an opportunity to do some of that work.
There are a lot of people here who are losing hope. They're picking up and moving away. There are prayer meetings specifically called to pray for miners and their families who have lost their jobs recently. And I suspect it's because they don't feel there's really anything else they can do but pray. As you continue to work in D.C. to try and find the resources and strategies to help these struggling economies, what do you want to say to the folks in the region? What do you want them to know right now?
Within West Virginia, within communities of West Virginia, people love their communities, and they're very committed to their communities. It's really inspiring to see that history and to experience it. But also within these communities are a group of incredible leaders who organize themselves and work to create opportunities, whether it's in Williamson or Welch or Princeton or Huntington. It is like an army of folks. They're mayors, they're teachers, they're nurses, but it's like an Appalachian army. And what I would say is that these resources are intended to provide a partnership to work with folks like that to help support the creation of other opportunities that will help strengthen and provide future for many of these communities throughout the region.
Mr. Gall, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
So how's the money really going to help Appalachia? Well, we don't know that either, but there are a few projects that the Power Plus plan has already funded with federal dollars from last year's budget. One of those programs funded by an ARC grant that's putting folks to work is called Reclaim Appalachia. Okay, get this. The group hires unemployed young adults to rehabilitate abandoned buildings by using recycling materials and training workers while they continue their education. They hire unemployed and underemployed, so if they're working fast food at minimum wage, they would still consider them for a spot on one of their work crews, which starts at $10 an hour.
Brandon Dennison is the founder of the Coalfield Development Corporation, which runs Reclaim Appalachia. Last year, he won a J.M. Kaplan Innovation Prize for his work. He spoke with Here and Now's Eric Westerveld about how the program not only offers jobs, but aims to address the social and educational problems of its participants.
So give us a thumbnail about this region in southern West Virginia, where we're talking about how has the decline of the coal industry affected cities and towns?
It's a really scary time in West Virginia right now. There's this sense that things are kind of collapsing around us. I think you gave some rough stats there, but the most jarring for me is that drug overdose. And the stat about that really indicates a complete loss of hope and no sense of a brighter future. And so that's what we're really up against. But West Virginia is a beautiful place. It's a culturally rich place. And so Reclaim Appalachia is all about trying to, rather than looking outside for a white knight to come in and save us, we're trying to build on the assets we do have and to reclaim that Appalachian spirit of craftsmanship to build the brighter future ourselves with our own hands.
Well, tell me about your Reclaim Appalachia project and how it works.
So it started with empty buildings. We have a lot of empty buildings because we've had a lot of out-migration. We have a lot of out-of-town, out-of-state landlords that aren't keeping up these properties. And we realized that everybody looked at these buildings like problems, but there was real opportunity in these buildings. And even though some of them had to come down, they had to be torn down because they were safety hazards, there were really good materials, valuable materials that could be reclaimed out of these buildings. And that would create local jobs, and it also had a green benefit because we kept all those materials out of the landfill. But we hire unemployed young adults to do that. Our trainees work what we call a 33-6-3 model every week. 33 hours a week they're working, paid, just like they would work for any other business, and that's a valuable experience for them. 6 hours a week they're in the community college classroom working towards an associate's degree. And 3 hours a week we do life skills coaching, like how to manage their money, time management, goal setting, teamwork, leadership, healthy living, really, really important so-called soft skills. So it's a 30-month contract. And at the end of their 30 months, they've earned an associate's degree, they've had valuable work experience, they've earned professional certifications, and then we work with the network of private employers to place them and start their career.
Give me an example of someone who's in your program now.
Absolutely. So we have a young person right now from Lincoln County, West Virginia, and was literally homeless at the time that he came on board with us. And the reason he was homeless was he found himself in a really toxic home environment and a lot of drugs involved there. And so this young man, we had a lot of challenges at first until we really figured out that we needed to address what was going on at home and really build up some of those emotional human resources. And ever since we've done that, he's thriving. He's enrolled full-time in community college, and he's really a great success story.
Brandon, West Virginia has been through hard times before, but as we noted, it also leads the nation in drug overdoses. There's a loss of hope on some level in some parts of the state. That must make your job incredibly hard right now. You're doing this during a very difficult time.
It does. I mean, a lot of what we're up against here is cynicism and fatalism in this sense that it's been bad, it's bad now, it's always going to be bad. And, you know, when I first came up with the idea, I was pitching my business plan, and this guy literally laughed in my face. And he said, "You're never going to find anybody that wants to work in southern West Virginia." And in fact, when we did our first round of interviews, we were recruiting crew members. We went to the vocational teacher's office, and I said, "I'm looking for some people to call." And he opened his file cabinet and just went through one folder after another, the last 3 years of his graduates, and just said, you know, unemployed, unemployed, on drugs, you know, car accident, injured in the mines, and it was just a very difficult situation. But if you get below the surface, you'll find some very resilient, very resourceful people that are finding a new way forward.
Well, congratulations on winning $175,000 from the J.M. Kaplan Fund's Innovation Prize. What are you going to do with the prize money?
Thank you. We're thrilled. We're honored. We're going to continue to grow. One of the things we're exploring, we have mountaintop removal. You know, it's this particularly aggressive form of mining whereby the tops of mountains are blown up to extract the coal easier, quicker, cheaper. And we have over 300,000 acres of mountains flattened and over 1,200 miles of stream bed covered up. And so what we're looking at is how to reclaim, again, reclaim Appalachia, how to reclaim these strip mine sites, how to build the soil base back up, how to look at renewable energy projects, solar and wind, and farming and agriculture. And so we're going to, with the Kaplan Fund, we're really going to try and innovate with these environmental hazards to convert those liabilities into assets.
Brandon, good luck to you. Brandon Dennison is founder of Reclaim Appalachia, part of the Coalfield Development Corporation, for which he's executive director. Brandon, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Brandon was speaking with Eric Westervelt, correspondent for NPR and guest host for Here and Now. By the way, we checked in with Brandon this week, and he says, in the face of such dire challenges in the coal industry, the program is expanding to include not only 18 to 25-year-olds, but older laid-off coal miners, too. In addition to revitalizing abandoned buildings, worker crews also install solar panels, learn sustainable agriculture, and woodworking. We've posted more information about the program on our website at wvpublic.org. Well, what do you think of a program like that? Do you have an idea that could help create more jobs? Well, we asked you on Twitter, and to help share some of your responses, our producer and reporter, Roxy Todd, joins us.
A 33-year-old listener in Princeton, West Virginia, Jeremy Winich, sent us a tweet that says he hopes more money will go to higher ed so that folks transitioning from coal can learn new trades, especially technology education. And he'd like to see more broadband access.
Over in Athens, Ohio, 28-year-old Sarah Kaplan would like lawmakers in Ohio to make it legal to make medical marijuana. She'd like the government to remove subsidies on fossil fuels, corn, wheat, and soy. Instead, she'd like to see the government subsidize health, clean energy, clean water, and clean air.
Another West Virginian, Emily Elmlinger, wrote, "Make childcare affordable and available for longer hours for women training for jobs or going to school." Emily is a former daycare provider. She says she knows it's hard to get ahead when you're a mom. Emily is 41 years old.
And 29-year-old Aaron DiStefano from Elkins, West Virginia, suggests instituting a work progress administration-type program, putting people to work burying power lines, beautifying our state, and improving schools.
And 31-year-old Jonathan Corcoran from Elkins, West Virginia, is now living up in Brooklyn, New York. He thinks the government should invest more in education, pump money into our schools, increase funding for arts, and increase teachers' pay to keep the best and brightest.
So those are just some of your ideas. How about you? Let's say you could decide how to spend millions of dollars to help Appalachia grow its economy and keep its young people here. Send us a tweet at @InAppalachia, and thanks.
Or you can also mail your letters to 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301.
Today on our show, we've been hearing from coal miners and people who are wondering what can be done to help the economy here in Appalachia. Wayne Lee Williams is a retired coal miner from Lashmi, West Virginia, not too far from me here in Mercer County. Wayne was at the Mercer County Heritage Festival, where he told his story to Malcolm Wilson. He said the thing he misses the most about coal mining is the close friends he made.
Well, I enjoyed it. I had my good times, my bad times. I enjoyed the men I worked with. And when you work underground, most of the time you get real close. Just like a brotherhood.
Yeah.
And some men you can't get close to, but most of the men that you work with are close. They're closer than your brother because you're with them 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, 5 and 6 days a week.
Wayne shared a story to Malcolm Wilson for the Humans of Central Appalachia Facebook page. While he was at the Heritage Festival, Malcolm also spoke with Aaron Owens, a high school teacher in Princeton. Aaron says he sees how the decline in the industry affects his students.
Their parents have lost their jobs. I mean, it's just sad to see how it affects these families in this area. And it's gotten about as bad, the economy has, about as bad as it's been since the 80s.
Some families are turning to higher education and hoping it will help provide a different future.
I'm the first Owens in 150 years that hasn't worked for the coal industry in some fashion. And probably won't. I don't know. I've got a geology degree, so that I might. There always seems to be a sense of gloom or despair that hangs in the air when you look at the economic situation. And I think that's kind of dampened some of the really proud moments. Like, you know, like I said, I graduated with a geology degree, and I graduated about the time the coal industry really took its hit. So that's one of the reasons why I've got an education degree, because of that. So it seems like that the happy is mixed with the sad around here.
But despite the economic issues he says are facing his community, Aaron says he loves it here and he can't imagine moving anywhere else.
I like Appalachian culture. I like old-timey music, and I like the fact that I'm around my family a lot. But even more than that, I think that if you keep your head about you and you're responsible and you work hard, you can have a pretty good life here in the Appalachian Mountains.
And he does think there's a lot of hope to help the economy here. He has some of his own ideas for ways to diversify Appalachia's economy, like farming and agriculture. He thinks the region will still be producing energy with coal, oil, natural gas, and maybe even geothermal energy.
But I think it's a mixed approach. I think you have to do things, you have to look at primary industries, things that have worked successfully in this region in the past, and apply them in new ways that will make it more sustainable for the future. I want to be a person who doesn't let his family down. That's what I want my legacy to be. I want to be one of the generations that pushes his family forward, not backwards.
Aaron Owens is a high school teacher in Princeton, West Virginia. He told his story to Malcolm Wilson with the Humans of Central Appalachia Project. You can learn more about Malcolm's project to collect stories throughout Appalachia on our website at wvpublic.org. As Aaron just said, things are tough here in the coal fields. Coal mining is a hard job, but these men and women are thankful to have a chance to work and provide for their families. They want to keep those jobs. Some of them have even endured unspeakable conditions and kept their mouths shut for fear of being blackballed from the industry and never being able to work again. Society has often looked down on the miners, and the media is quick to pick up on the stereotypical stories from this area. But more and more coal miners are starting to find their voice and to tell their own stories. Gary Bentley spent 12 years as an underground coal miner in Kentucky before he left the industry in 2013. He started writing about his experiences recently in an effort to combat stereotypes about coal miners he sees in the media and popular culture. So he began writing a blog called In the Black for the rural news website The Daily Yonder. In his column, he shares stories from his career in the mines. He recently discussed his experiences and his writing with WFPL's Erica Peterson.
So at this point, we've only had, four columns
four.
That have been published. And so reading those, you talk about kind of the first days of why you entered the mines and then you left and then why you went back. And honestly, reading them, I had no idea that you had such a relatively long career, 12 years in the mines, because we haven't gotten that far in the timeline. But can you talk a little bit about what it was like to start in the mines and then why you left and why you went back?
Yeah, I mean, growing up in southeastern Kentucky, especially when you're born and raised there, the life of a coal miner, like I said, it's romanticized. But also in that area, you see, you know, nice homes, you see nice cars, boats, motorcycles, these people that are living a very comfortable, good life. And a lot of those are coal miners. And for me, I wanted to go to college. I didn't want to work in the coal mines. But my parents couldn't afford to pay for college. I didn't receive financial aid. And I didn't do well enough in high school to get scholarships. So in order to go to college, I had to pay for it. And really, working underground was the only way. So it was terrifying. I was completely taken back. You know, I show up and here are all these men. And at the time, very large men, quite intimidating. I was a small, frail, essentially teenager right out of high school, and the work was extremely hard, or at least it seemed to be at the time. And so I would often question myself, you know, do I really want to do this? So of course I left, ended up in a cabinet factory for just a few weeks, And, you know, once again, I was like, okay, I really want to live a good life. I want to pay for college. I want to do better. At some point, I want to have a family. And I went back underground.
What was the salary difference like between, you know, beginning coal miner and cabinet factory?
Okay, so entry-level coal miners, if you got a job with a company, you could make anywhere from $15 to $20 an hour. And then at the cabinet factory, I want to say it was around $8 to $10 an hour.
And so ultimately, I mean, after even after working for, I guess, a decade at this point in Eastern Kentucky in the coal mines, you still lost your job and had to look elsewhere. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and I want to say it was in 2010, 2011, the business was getting hit pretty hard. There were a lot of layoffs, a lot of companies shutting down, a lot of the smaller companies had already closed and were not able to continue running. At that time, I was pretty fortunate. I had gotten every certification you could get for underground, and I did have my degree in mine management and safety, so I was able to kind of hold on for that last little bit. But in the, I think it was June of 2012, I was essentially informed that the company I was working for was shutting down all operations in Eastern Kentucky, and then was fortunate enough to find a job in Muhlenberg County, you know, in Western Kentucky. And it was a 6-hour drive from my daughter who lived in Whitesburg. But it offered me the opportunity to continue making a good living and to be able to provide for her.
Even though it may never play the same role in Eastern Kentucky's economy, do you think coal will always be a part of the culture there?
I look at it as sort of kind of the way of old-time string music. I mean, it's still being held on to. It's actually thriving right now. And I think coal mining will be the same way because it's something, it's our heritage, it's what we grew up with. So yeah, I think it's something that will always be held on to and looked at and viewed in the history of Southeastern Kentucky.
But the history, not the future at this point.
Definitely not the future. I don't see any future in coal. It's a non-renewable resource. It's not sustainable for the area, so how can it be a future?
That was former coal miner Gary Bentley, who recently started a regular blog called In the Black. We'll be hearing more from Gary in next week's show. Around here, people have been hesitant to speak up or complain about some of the tough realities, but maybe that's starting to change. As we've heard today on our show, many people across Appalachia are worried about what type of future might be available for their families if the economy here continues to decline. What's going to be here for our children? Do we want the same for them as we had? Or do we want better? We won't be on this earth forever. They'll have to carry on without us eventually. I think it's up to us. We're at a critical time right now. The decisions we make today will live forever in the legacy of our children.
Just like the songs I leave behind me, I'm gonna live forever now. You fathers and you mothers, be good to one another. Please try to raise your children right. Don't let the darkness take them. Don't make them feel forsaken. Just lead them safely to the light. When this old world is blown asunder and all the stars fall from the sky, remember someone really loves you. We'll live forever, you and I.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WBUR in Boston, WFPL in Louisville, and the Humans of Central Appalachia Project. Music in today's show was also provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, James Reams and the Barnstormers, Jake Sheps, Clarence Green, and Larry Gross from his new CD, Live Forever. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Glennis Board and Jesse Wright edited our show this week. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.